The views expressed on the following show are not necessarily those of the guest, host, or SaratogaBroadcasting.com. Talk of the Town is a production of Saratoga Broadcasting Incorporated. And now the host of Talk of the Town, Lynn Goodness and Rick Thompson.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of the Town on this Friday, October the 3rd in the year 2014. I'm going to introduce our guest first because I have a comment to make after I introduce him, but he's a regular on our stations here at Talk Saratoga and SaratogaBroadcasting.com on the internet, and also Talk Saratoga on Skidmore Radio 91.1 FM, which you can stream on the internet. But Lynn won't be with us this morning. He's got some matters to attend to, and I was going to say Gordon has been here more than Lynn has, so good morning, Gordon.
Good morning. Good morning, Rick.
How are you?
Good, good, and I appreciate having me back and the opportunity to talk about politics.
Yeah, it's coming up quick, and got a bunch of races this coming November. A lot of local races, state races, and federal, and some of the and I know I want to get into talking about, you know, our political system and, you know, can it be changed, how can it be changed, and you know, what the little things are that are happening now than happened 50-100 years ago. But why don't we talk about the let's talk about state first, because this is an interesting election for governor that we have here. Now, my take on it is that not many people like Governor Cuomo, but he's probably going to win by a large margin. And you, of course, are going to either agree with me or disagree with me, and if you do, you're going to tell me what your opinions are. My opinion is that the Republicans never put anybody up against him that can give him a good run. And the last time they did was a moderate Republican in Governor Pataki. And as we know, I mean, he was reelected for a few terms. So what's your take on that?
Let me get into the governor race, but I wanted to bring it within a framework, if you will, that our political system is in trouble, and the governor race is only one indication, and we can go from local to national, or national, local, state, and national, in that order, if you would. Once the American public gets beyond Sunday night, Monday night, and now Thursday night football, and gets beyond George Clooney's marriage, he's a young, and by the way, he's a young Cary Grant, in my opinion. And once the American public gets beyond whether Jeopardy's Alec Trebek should keep his mustache or shave it off, mm-hmm. once people get beyond that, they will realize that, in fact, there is a election and midterm and a governor race coming up within a month. And what's the old phrase from TV? Shazam! People would say Shazam! I gotta begin paying attention. My theme is that our political system is really in trouble, and for a lot of reasons, which hopefully we can cover at least some of them. It's in trouble because there's a public alienation from politics. It's not something that people want to pay attention to. It's not something that people are more interested in than George Clooney's wedding. And that's a sad commentary, in my opinion, on where we are in terms of our political system within the United States. In terms of the governorship, for those who may be listening outside of New York, I'm sure you're aware that we have Andrew Cuomo, who is running for his second term. He is a symbol, symbolic, I believe, of a type of politics which is anti-democratic, and I say that with a small d. He's very autocratic, highly secretive. An example would be the SAFE Act, which is highly unpopular upstate. He got through the legislature, I think, after midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning. The SAFE Act is an anti-gun control or anti-ammunition, essentially anti-ammunition law, which hopefully would cut down on random mass shootings. But Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo, who is the son of Mario Cuomo, who served three terms, going back, he served 12 years. He ran for a fourth term, Mario, and he lost to George Pataki in 1994. People got tired of Mario.
Yeah, he was in for 12
years. But it took a while. In the case of his son, Andrew, people seemed to be tired of him much quicker than they were of his father. Andrew is autocratic. He has gotten budgets passed on time. The question to a lot of people is whether they were good budgets, whether they served the needs of the state residents and voters and property taxpayers. He's not popular. He's autocratic. And what you find here in terms of the response to Andrew Cuomo's autocratic method of governing is a revolt, if you will. Those who have been following New York State politics, Andrew was challenged first through the Family Worker Party, which is a union-based party out of New York City, essentially. A professor, Teachout, Zypher Teachout, a very bright lady, a law professor, challenged Andrew Cuomo within the Workers' Party's conference, and she got about 30% of the vote.
Yeah, I was surprised on that one, and I think she would have been good, too.
But she stayed in the race. She gathered enough signatures to stay in the race in primary Andrew Cuomo. And part of Andrew Cuomo's, what I would again declare his anti-democratic small d politics, which turns people off, is not tolerating a primary, but to try to force her off the ballot. He went to court to claim that she didn't live for a five-year period in New York State. She didn't have a legal address in New York State. She won that fight. She won that legal battle. She remained on the ballot. Andrew refused to debate her in a primary. Another anti-democratic symbol.
Symbol.
And the results were very interesting in terms of our state politics and our national politics. Andrew Cuomo won downstate. New York City against Teachout in the primary. He won Syracuse. He won the big cities, Syracuse, Buffalo, and New York City, all the five boroughs of New York City. The problem is that he lost upstate. Teachout beat him throughout the Albany region, which is a lot of state employee voters who resent Andrew Cuomo's attempt to set up a new retirement tier system.
Right. And heavily Democratic, we might add.
And heavily Democratic. But he lost upstate to Teachout. He lost probably about 5 to 7 counties in the Albany region. And it was based on an alienation from Andrew Cuomo's method of governing, his anti-democratic method, if you will. He's going to win the election, and part of the politics that is taking place throughout the country is that he has no competition. You mentioned at the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
Teachout is no longer on the ballot. She may endorse him, she may not. What you're left with is that you have Rob Astorino, who is the Westchester County executive, a very a man who may be a good executive, but he lacks charisma. He lacks the pizzazz that people like to think that a governor should have. And he doesn't have the money. The money has dried up even after the primary with Teachout. Andrew Cuomo is still accumulating millions of dollars.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly from Wall Street and the construction industry, the hedge funders. And it's that type of anti-democratic politics which Rob Astorino can't compete against. The only other alternative on the ballot would be the candidate, which is Hawkins. The Green Party is interesting. They need to be on the ballot. They need 50,000 signatures. And the Green Party can remain on the ballot in New York State if they get that number for the next 4 years, throughout the next electoral term. So it's important that they run a candidate. They did get 50,000 votes last time.
Oh, okay.
Hawkins was running. He's running again. But the progressive wing of the Democratic Party, large D, is not going to automatically go to Green Party and Hawkins. The Green Party is interesting because it began, those who are familiar with the history of the Green Party here in the United States, began as an environmental party promoting green politics.
Sure. Ralph Nader, I think, was the
Ralph Nader was a candidate at one time. But it has morphed into a more economic rather than environmental, although the environmental issues are still a component of the Green Party platform. But it's become highly economic. And Hawkins, he's a unionist out of the Syracuse region. I think he's a Teamster, worked for the Teamsters for a long time. And when he was asked, are you a socialist, he said, yes, I am. In the European sense, I'm a socialist. And because of that, people are not going to automatically gravitate who voted for Teachout against Andrew Cuomo. They're not going to automatically gravitate to the Green Party candidate. So where do people go? They're left with Andrew Cuomo, who is not popular upstate. He will come out of New York City with probably about 60% of the vote, which is normal for a Democratic gubernatorial candidate. He would lose a lot of upstate, the Albany region. He would take the larger cities again. His new lieutenant governor, she is helping him in the Rochester area, in upstate. So he will win. He'll probably win with 55 to 60% of the vote. But he will win without serious political competition. And my theme here this morning is that he's a symbol of of the anti-democratic politics which we're seeing across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Across the country.
And I, you know, that's going to be a main topic this morning, but, you know, staying on the subject for a little bit about, you know, the governor's race, what do you think, if anything, that Upstate can do to counteract the political effect of downstate? I mean, more than half of the population in New York State resides in a small area of New York City and the surrounding areas, coming upstate just a little bit, Westchester County and that. But we can never break into a majority of the assembly, because most of the assembly is from downstate because of the population.
Mm-hmm.
So is there anything that it hasn't been done in I don't know how many years, but...
That element you just described is, to me, it's the element that makes New York State a deeply blue state, which is not going to change. It's not going to change. The New York City, there is an idea that's been floated around for decades that we need to divide into two different states. We need an upstate and we need a downstate. Separate, not necessarily equal, but separate.
Mm-hmm.
Because the interest of upstate residents and voters and the population is so distinct and different in so many ways than New York City. But that idea is dead on arrival. It had always been dead on arrival. It's not going to take place. And that, to me, perhaps is the only solution to the dilemma that you described. That we're a deep blue state, and we will remain a deep blue state in terms of Democratic, large, capital D, for a long time. The Green Party is not going to become a major party in New York State. The Republican Party is, to me, it's rather sad, but the problem with Astorino is that even after the primary, even after some weaknesses became very visible and obvious after mm-hmm. Teachout's primary against Cuomo, even after that, and the money, the Wall Street, the hedge funders, have not gravitated toward Astorino, either because they say, well, he's not going to win. I'm not
right.
going to throw my money away. But the fact is that Andrew Cuomo has locked up the street money and the hedge fund money.
But I would say that if when Cuomo came out of that primary, if Astorino had money behind him, there Teachout pierced the armor. And I think if Astorino had the money behind him, he could have gotten into that piercing.
Mm-hmm.
He could have opened that up, but he didn't have the money to do it. Because she went after Cuomo on so many different subjects that I think if somebody could have kept hammering away at him. But what have we heard about Astorino in the last month or two? Mm-hmm. Nothing. He throws a few ads on TV, which seem ridiculous to me, talking about older people eating soup. And we don't hear much from him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm saying. Republican candidates can not get the money behind them in New York to make a good effort in a gubernatorial race here.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Astorino made a major address down in New York City on Wednesday to a conference on a better New York, where he laid out his platform. And what he advocated was reducing our income tax brackets here in New York State to two. One would be 4% for all those making less than $200,000. And the other bracket would be 6% for all those making over $200,000. He also wants to eliminate the estate tax that you pay, your estate pays once you die.
Mm-hmm.
These are very conservative issues, his approach. It's a 6% for all everyone making over $200,000 is a very conservative supply-side economic program. And there's no way that the progressive wing of the Democratic Party is even going to consider Astorino with those types of policies. And the Green Party or independents. There's an independents party. There are independents who are real independents.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to find it hard to go to Astorino even before you begin talking about the social issues. Like equal pay,
mm-hmm.
abortion rights, Safe Act, the gun control. If you want to put that into the social issue mix, there's no way that those who favor policies of that kind are going to move to Astorino. So he's really not going to win.
Right. It's almost he's got some of Ronald Reagan's ideas in the estate tax issue, and I don't know about the
reduce the top rate,
and but you know, like you say, he hasn't got enough issues to sway Democrats over to his side either, and I think that's the difference between him and George Pataki. Pataki was a moderate Republican who could appeal to some Democrats, and I think that's what got him elected, was that he was, you know, I mean, a Republican, but yet he was willing to work with Democrats on some of their issues, and I think that's what appealed to Democrats.
Plus exhaustion with Mario Cuomo.
Oh, it happened at the right time, most definitely. Yeah. Most definitely.
Let me continue this theme, getting to the midterm, the congressional races.
Yep.
In the House, as most of our listeners would know, there are a total of 435 congressional districts. And the problem is that because of our anti-democratic, anti-political elements that are present that we've seen at the state level. Of the 435, 50 are really competitive. And of those 50, most of the experts acknowledge that maybe 15 to 20 of those 50 congressional seats are really competitive, that it's still up in the air on who's going to win. But the sad part is that of the 435 congressional districts, there are less than 50 which anybody should pay attention to. If we go locally, you can spend tons and millions of dollars on TV ads.
Mm-hmm.
But there's not going to be a defeat of Paul Tonko, who was in the Safe District,
right?
Or Chris Gibson. Gibson's the last recent polling show, he's about 25 points ahead,
mm-hmm.
of his competitor. So why should anybody pay attention, and why should they be pouring money into media ads? And I'm talking about Chris Gibson and Tonko.
Right.
When it's guaranteed that they will win,
right? And they're throw an ad or two in once in a while to keep the name out there, but don't heavily.
But it's anti. Okay. It's not competitive, and so people can say I'm more interested in Alex Trebek's mustache,
right,
than I am in the races with Chris Gibson and Paul Tonko. I want to also mention while we're locally here, In terms of the House races, the 21st District up here, they're pouring ads. They're ubiquitous. They're all over the airwaves. Elise Stefanik, who's a 28-year-old. Paul Ryan, she's channeling Paul Ryan in terms of Paul Ryan's positions on Medicare, Medicaid, privatization of those in the future, and also Medicaid in terms of providing a voucher for Medicaid that the feds would provide a voucher to the states on Medicaid, and it would be smaller than what the feds are giving states on Medicaid now. But it would be also a lot of discretion that the states would have on how to spend the money. And so it's a voucherization of Medicaid and a privatization of Social Security and Medicare. And Elise, she's 28 years old. She spent a lot of time in Washington. They have it add up now that she has a townhouse. And she doesn't milk cows up here, but she has a townhouse in Washington. And she's channeling Paul Ryan. She's close to Paul Ryan. And she's using, it's a somewhat competitive race, but the 21st District has been reconfigured and redistricted. And it, you know, many people would say it's not really a competitive district anymore. You got about 183,000 Republicans. You got about 127,000 Democrats. About 89,000 Independents. So what her opponent, Aaron Wolf, who's also a carpet bagger from New York City, what he has to do is draw the more moderate Republicans away from Elise, keep his Democratic base, and also get a lot of independent, small ID independents to vote for him.
Now you're talking about independent, not independents.
There's
right?
an independence party.
There's an independence party.
But the independents, right. those who register, do not register with any party.
No party or independent. Right.
There's about 89,000 up here in the 21st District. Mm-hmm. For those who may be listening outside of New York State, the 21st is up north, Saratoga, parts of Saratoga Springs, Glens Falls, the Adirondack area. And it covers almost the entire Adirondack landmass, a lot of small towns. And it takes a 28-year-old young lady with a lot of energy mm-hmm. to even want to consider representing this district. But that used to be before the redistricting and the reconfiguring. The 21st used to be a competitive district. I worked a little bit with Murphy, mm-hmm. Scott Murphy. He ran in a special election against with Tedisco.
Yeah,
but the 21st, and that was the 21st. But at that time, the 21st cut down much further south.
Right,
it was a much more competitive district, and Murphy ran one. He served 1 year, mm-hmm. and then he lost to Chris Gibson.
Yep.
But he lost after it had become redistricted.
Yep.
And people asked him, Murphy, recently, why don't you run again? Why don't you run again in the 21st? He said, I'm not interested. No. I'm really not interested.
Murphy was in 1 year, and he was there long enough to vote for Obamacare.
He voted for Obamacare. He's one of the what they call the Blue Dog Democrats, conservative. He's really an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
I believe he's working down in Malta, the nanotechnology
the new, yeah.
area. He's really an entrepreneur. He was one of the Blue Dog Democrats who were wiped out in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not going to run again. And so Elise probably will win. And it's no longer, even the 21st District as it's configured now, is not really competitive. But going back to the total of 435 congressional districts, only 50 are competitive, and of those 50, maybe 15 or 20 are really in play, what they call in play. The Congressional Republican Conference, the House, John Boehner's group, they have what they call the drive to 245. They now have 234 seats. The Democrats in the House have 201. And most experts believe that the Republicans are very likely to pick up 10 to 12 more seats. But the House Congressional Committee, which is coordinating the campaigns, they have a goal of 245 seats. If they get 245 seats, that would make them the largest Republican conference in the House since Harry Truman in 1946.
Oh, really?
Election. So it would be very historic. But there's absolutely no doubt that the Republicans are going to hold on to the House.
Hold the majority.
It's not really competitive.
Yeah.
15 or 20 seats are worth even paying any attention to across the country. And of those, if they do get to 245, John Boehner's major problem is looking over his shoulder because they're going to be more conservative, perhaps more Tea Party candidates that win, and they want to move John out.
Yeah, they want a more conservative agenda.
They want a more conservative agenda than John Boehner is willing to give him.
Yeah. Well, how about the Senate?
I'm getting to the Senate, but I wanted to mention the House because of how uncompetitive it is and how undemocratic it is. In the Senate, it's more interesting. Right now, my graduate school friend, Stu Rothenberg, who you may see on the TV a lot, the Rothenberg Report out of Washington. He's been in Washington for about 30, 40 years. I call his office. I don't talk to him. He doesn't talk to someone like me anymore. But his staff indicate that the odds are about 60 to 40% that the Republicans would take over control of the Senate. And the reason for that is because most of the Senate contests which are in play are Romney anti-Obama states, particularly along the South and in the Upper South, and the Democrats have to hold on or try to hold on to those seats. And the odds are that the Republicans right now, the breakup is 55 Democrats and 45 Republicans in the Senate. But of those 55, two were independents. Yeah, Bernie Sanders from over here in Vermont.
Yeah.
And also Rufus King out of Maine, who's an independent. They vote, caucus with the Democrats, and they vote generally with the Democrats. So if you add those two, you come up with 55. Currently 55 Democrats and 45 Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
The experts, including my graduate school buddy Rothenberg's office, indicates that the result probably will be end up with about 52 Republicans and 48 Democrats. Okay. And that even includes the two independents.
Mm-hmm.
So what will happen? What will happen if the Republicans take over the Senate? Well, it will make the last 2 years, at least domestically, for Barack Obama. He will have many more gray hairs domestically in the next 2 years. Most of what he'll be able to accomplish may be through executive action with his pen or foreign policy, whether that's going to end up good or bad.
Yeah. It's not looking too good.
It is very debatable. But his last 2 years, if the Republicans take over the Senate and have the House, very difficult years for Barack Obama. Mitch McConnell is the Democratic majority in the Senate at the current time. The Republican majority leader out of Kentucky. He's up for re-election. His opponent is a dynamic lady, Grimes, who's the Attorney General currently in Kentucky. Elizabeth Warren, the fervent populist out of Massachusetts, has made forays into Kentucky.
Yeah.
In support of Grimes. The goal is to defeat
McConnell.
It's not likely. McConnell probably will come in with 53-55% of the vote. What will he do, and what will the Republicans do if they take over the Senate? Well, in terms of the institution itself, they would then control the agenda. They would be the chairwomen of the Senate congressional committees. They would have many more perquisites, like bigger offices and more travel money. But Mitch McConnell also, in a closed-door conference, sponsored by the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers, as most people would know here, are the two brothers out of the old Koch family. They're each worth about a net, estimated net worth of $41 billion, each one of them. But they have a vast network. In many ways, they're libertarians, but they're Tea Party supporters. Their money is being poured into getting a Republican Senate, as well as holding the House, which is not difficult to do. But in a private closed-door conference, Mitch McConnell described to the Koch brother supporters what he would do. And he said, look, we will take over the Senate, and what we'll do is within budget bills, we will put things like repealing Obamacare, repealing a lot of the left, what they consider left-wing proposals and programs and agenda of Barack Obama. And once we do that, once they're part of the budget bill and they get through a filibuster and they get to Obama's desk, he's going to have a great dilemma of either vetoing a budget which may have an attachment repealing Obamacare, but it would be a budget bill. And if he vetoes that, Mitch McConnell says the government will close down.
Right.
He says that's what we're going to be doing. Now, he could be embellishing his ability to do that to the Koch brothers' network of people, but that's what he was recorded as saying behind closed doors. So it's going to be a very tough 2 years if the Republicans take over the Senate. Right now, the Senate contests which are still in play. North Carolina, Kay Hagan, who's a Democrat, she's running for her second term. North Carolina is a very, very conservative state, dominated by a Republican legislature, who has come up with some extreme conservative proposals and bills and whatever. But she's holding her own, Kay Hagan, the Democrat in North Carolina. It looks fairly good for her. But once you get down beyond North Carolina, you go down to Louisiana, Mary Landrieu. Her brother is the mayor of New Orleans. A long time reputable family in Louisiana, the Landrieus. She's running for her second term. And right now the polls indicate that it's going to be a very tough race for her. In fact, the latest polls seem to indicate, the composite of the latest polls indicates she may be 3 to 5 points down. But the interesting thing about Louisiana is that it has a runoff. In other words, you have two top candidates in November, and Mary Landrieu could be one of them. The top two run against each other in a runoff in December. So we the Senate, the composite makeup of the Senate may not be known until the end of the year, not necessarily next month. But she's in trouble. In Arkansas, Pryor is running for a second term. The Pryor family, he was a former governor in Arkansas. Bill Clinton will be down there in the next 2 or 3 weeks giving support to him.
That could be bad.
But he's in trouble. I mean, the polls are indicating that he's really in a struggle.
Right.
In Arkansas. In Alaska, Bettridge is also in trouble. Alaska really is a purple, red state, mostly red in terms of Republican. And it's a very iffy race. Money's going to be poured into Alaska. Sarah Palin will be out there, and hopefully she won't bring her daughters and they won't have a brawl out there, a drunken brawl.
But I'll tell you, though, you know, it's surprising how much Sarah Palin is still liked by women.
Very, very visible.
Right.
She's very visible.
Not men so much. They tend to put her down and drag her down, but among women, she's known as a firebrand, and I think women like that, you know.
And see, what else did I mention? Colorado. Morris Udall. Stuart Udall, for those of us old enough, a very likable presidential candidate going back to the 1980s. And his two sons, one is in New Mexico, senator. He's going to be reelected. But Morris Udall in Colorado seems to be in trouble. It's a very close race on there. It's a toss-up. Colorado has moved to legalization of marijuana. It has moved far in terms of the social agenda. And Morris Udall has to pull himself back to the center. Even though it's a very popular family, the Udalls, he seems to be in trouble in Colorado. So what I have summarized here is that it's about a 60-40 odds that the Republicans would take over the Senate. So what's it going to be? Larry Sabato out of the University of Virginia indicates that we have several possibilities. It could be simply what he calls a beach week. And the beach week is where his students in the University of Virginia, or Skidmore students, they go down to Florida for the spring break. And the beach week, in terms of the results of the Senate, it could be just a small wave that, and I'm quoting, a small wave that crashes loudly but does little to any structured damage in terms of the Democrats in the Senate. That's the most comfortable
outlook that
the Democrats have, and he calls it the beach week. And then you have what the Republicans really would like to see, and that would be a tidal wave or a tsunami. Am I pronouncing that correctly? And what the tsunami would do is not only wipe out all the contests which I have listed here in North Carolina, Arkansas, Louisiana, Colorado, Alaska, but it would also wipe out Shanine up here in New Hampshire, where Scott Brown? Yes.
Scott Brown was in Massachusetts, wasn't he?
Yeah, then he's moved to New Hampshire. He's running against her.
Oh, okay.
A Tosami would wipe her out, and Scott Brown would win in New Hampshire. And even with a Tosami, our friend Al Franken in Minnesota could be wiped out. Right now, he's a very comfortable lead of 10 to 15 points.
Yeah. Well, I mean, of course, the best outlook for the Republicans would be to win by a vast majority of seats. But realistically, if it's 51 to 49, they still have the majority, so they can still control the Senate. Maybe they need more numbers to. Of course, on a.
You must remember though, Joe Biden could still vote if it's 51 to 49.
Mm-hmm.
Biden could move into make it a 50-50. Even if the Republicans held all their loyal senators.
Right. Oh, I thought Biden could only vote on a tie. I thought he could only vote to break a tie.
He could vote on a tie.
Okay.
You're right. But a 51-49 is a very small margin.
Oh, most definitely. Because you always have one party side with another. So just one very liberal Republican could side with the Democrats and make it 50-50. And then Biden could put his vote in to tip the scale. But, that's what I said. They'd want to win by more. But, I mean, realistically, if you could rein the Republicans in on an issue, let's just say Obamacare, you're going to need more than one because there are Republicans that won Obamacare. You know what I mean? So you're going to need quite a bit more, I think, than just the one vote.
I want to get into, in the few remaining minutes, Rick, some possible reforms. I've tried to convey the theme here that our politics and our political system is in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
It's not competitive. There's a lot of things. There's too much money floating around. Technology people have really taken over the campaign. So reforms are necessary. Let me just throw out two or three that have been proposed, and without giving any odds on them. First, I wanted to mention that to change the Constitution, there are two ways to do it. Most people talk about going through Congress, which is two-thirds. You need two-thirds of Congress, both houses, mm-hmm. Voting on a constitutional amendment, and then it goes back to the states, mm-hmm. and you need three-fourths of the states to agree to that amendment. So you have to go through Congress and then the states to get an amendment to the Constitution. But there's another way, and it's a way that has gotten support even from the left and the right. Rush Limbaugh,
mm-hmm.
supports this other possibility, and that would be to call a constitutional convention. And a constitutional convention would simply allow two-thirds of the states to come up with amendment possibilities, which would be voted upon.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people like Rush Limbaugh would like this because they would like amendments to the Constitution, like a balanced budget. On the social issues,
sure.
Abortion and same-sex marriage. But in terms of just overall reform, that is the alternative way to go about it. And there are some proposals that have been thrown out for a long time. Nothing has ever happened. Is that the House members be elected for a four-year term. Right now, of course, they're two-year terms.
Mm-hmm.
The first year for most House members are spent raising money, and then the second year of their two-year term is spent paying off those who gave them the money during the first year.
And running for re-election again.
And running for re-election.
Now, just a sidebar between that, what's the Saratogian political system? It's a two-year term, and that's exactly what happens here. A person gets elected, there's a learning curve of 6-7 months, feeling your way around. Just like Congress, I mean, they have to feel their way around, get to know the political circles, and then the beginning of the next year, they're running for election again. So two-year terms really do not benefit citizens, mm-hmm. you know.
But a four-year term for the House would also mean that you eliminate what's called the midterm.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have a midterm election like what's coming up now. The one in 2010, and it does allow, as you describe it, a member of the House and at least up here in the 21st district, even though she's only 28 years old,
mm-hmm.
it would allow her to slow down a little bit.
Oh, sure.
And look a little bit to the future in terms of what the policies should be. How do you deliberate? And it would also mean that it used to be that in Congress, in the House, members would have lunch together.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, with a 2-year term, they're forced to come back to the district 4 days out of 7, generally.
Yep.
And that's what Elise will be doing. She will be 2 days, 3 days in Washington.
The rest of the time flying around the Adirondack.
And it doesn't develop camaraderie. It doesn't develop cooperation. It doesn't develop the ability to sit down and have lunch with another member of the House.
Well, sure, and that's the negative of a 2-year term. Plus, you can't, just like here in the city, you can't develop a long-term goal that you yourself will be able to work on, because you may come up with a goal. 2 years later, you may not be there to see that, to implement your work, and now somebody else starts over from the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I always remember this story about how Ronald Reagan and Tip O'Neill used to argue like crazy, but they'd have dinner together.
Mm-hmm.
They understood each other, and they still remained friends even though they were on the opposite side of the aisle. Today, you don't see that.
Chris Matthews, who worked for Tip O'Neill.
Mm-hmm.
Chris Matthews, he has a great book on the Gipper and Tip O'Neill, and describing exactly what you described.
Yep.
How they had their differences, but at the end of the day, they could have a little bit of a drink, and they could trade Irish stories.
Yep.
And build up rapport, camaraderie.
And don't think that doesn't help when you are discussing issues, because you're more apt to listen to the other person when you socialize with them civilly, rather than just sit across from the aisle. If you don't get to know people, you have an automatic, you don't trust them,
mm-hmm.
okay? And I think that's what goes on in our politics today. There's not a lot of trust between members of the opposite party, and you hit it on the head. They don't spend enough time together. And therefore, they don't get to know each other and can't appreciate each other. Sure, you're going to have your difference of opinion, but you don't have to hate each other because you have a difference of opinion.
A couple other reforms quickly in the remaining minutes. A 6-year term for the presidency. 1 6-year term. Some people say, well, you have a 6-year term for a president. In other words, the first year, a president would be a lame duck. Yeah, no, I don't buy that argument. But 1 6-year term, you don't get involved, and you eliminate the midterm House races.
Right.
One 6-year term for a president can create a lot of stability. And if you ask Barack Obama, it's a man, 6 years, I think, is enough in this job.
You ever see a president going in and what they look like coming out?
That's right. That's right. And if a president is corrupt, incompetent, bad, there are constitutional ways to deal with that within a 6-year period of time. Finally, a final reform would be our founding fathers had a great, what they called the great bargain when they formed our government. The House was to be based on population equal, and then the Senate would be based on 2 senators for each state, big and small, and that was a compromise that allowed the small states to give support to the Constitution.
Sure.
To me, and to others who favor a reform of this kind, this is only one possibility in terms of the Senate. Believe that would be archaic at the current time. Why not make the Senate? Here's what you have with the Senate, very quickly. You have the 25 most populous, in terms of population, states. They have about 264 million in population, and they have 50 senators. Those are the top 25.
Mm-hmm.
And you also had 25 least popular, in terms of population, states. They have 52 million in comparison to 264 million, but they still get 50 seats. That was part of the great compromise of our founding fathers.
Mm-hmm.
I say let's move beyond that. Let's move beyond that. And how do you change the Senate? Well, you base it on population again. You base it on population. People will say, yeah, but that violates the great compromise that our founding fathers had. But the times were different. You had to bargain between the big and the small state. Suppose we change the Senate to be based on population, and you're not limited to 2 senators for each state. On one proposal, California would have 6 senators. Texas, New York, and Florida would have 5. Chuck Schumer would love that, wouldn't he?
Yeah.
Illinois and Pennsylvania would have 4 senators. Ohio, Georgia, Michigan, and North Carolina had 3. And then the smaller states from New Jersey down to Connecticut would have 2 each. And then from Iowa down to Wyoming would have 1 senator, which Wyoming would not like too well. But with that breakdown, you still end up with 100 senators, which is what we have now.
Now, we have a minute and a half left, and I just want to tell you I don't like that. And the reason why is I think we'd have a situation similar to what we have in New York with downstate ruling upstate. You'd have the bigger states making all the decisions for the smaller states, and the smaller states wouldn't have the numbers to go up against the larger states, even if they all stuck together.
So if New York had 5 senators, they would all come from New York City then?
Well, I'm not even that, but I mean, they probably would, but what I'm using the term what happens in New York to what happens nationally. But, you know, here again, that's a good topic for our next show. Gordon, I want to thank you for being here today.
Well, Rick, I appreciate you having me back again, and maybe a possibility to invite me back after the election.
We'll do that.
To see what happened.
What we talked today, if we knew what we were talking about.
whether it's a Tosami or a...
beach party.
A beach party, yes.
Will do. Okay, I want to thank everybody for listening, and hope you'll tune in tomorrow to Talk Saratoga. Which is on from 8 to 9 on Skidmore Radio 91.1 FM. And for Rick Thompson and Gordon Cannon, we want to say good day.